Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Phil Bronstein, as you already know. I'll be your moderator for today's program called The Rise of Islamic Radicalism. I would venture to say probably the most vexing, arguably the most vexing and really frightening, terrifying issue of our time. And before I introduce our distinguished panel, I just want to say something. They're going to talk about what their perspectives are from each of their countries and what's going on with each of their countries relative to this issue. And they have a mandate from the Commonwealth Club, which is really, I think, extraordinary. Is there any way to reconcile deep-rooted religious, societal, and political differences to stop the cycle of violence from spinning further out of control? That's a hell of a mandate for our guests and for all of us. I think particularly because the answer is perhaps no. There is nothing we can do. I hope that's not the answer. But I just want to say for a second where we stand from my perspective in the United States. This morning, if you listen to the hysterical cable news channels, and they are always hysterical, Ramadi fell to ISIS in the last day. Their flag, which we've all become familiar with, is rising above the town. That's in Anbar province, where the U.S. government and U.S. treasure and personnel were spent, and many people were killed there already. So what do we know? I was walking with my son recently on Mount Tam, and he said, "Dad, what scares you?" And we had the usual snakes and spiders conversation. But I thought afterwards, what's really the answer to that question? The real answer to that question is, what I don't know scares me. And I have a quote here from Major General Michael Nagata, who was the Special Operations Commander in the Mideast, said recently, "We have not defeated the idea," he's talking about Islamic fundamentalism and ISIS, "we don't even understand the idea." So that scares me. Tom Ridge, the former Homeland Security Secretary, said we are the most unsafe in this country since 9/11 today. My own profession, if I were an editor of a newspaper today or a media outlet, I don't think I would send reporters to cover ISIS because we've seen the horror of what's happened to them when we do. And at the same time, the understanding that we need to have and that we hope to help glean from our guest today, the Atlantic Monthly recently said, we have to understand the religious millenarian group. They have to be understood to be combated. We have to know the intellectual genealogy. And then there are, of course, endless issues that come out of that, including immigration, poverty, culture. Okay. So I've said my piece. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. Paulina Carmona is the Consul General of France in the middle. Stefan Schluter is the Consul General of Germany in San Francisco, right here to my immediate left. And Andy David is the Consul General of Israel to the Pacific Northwest. So please join me in welcoming our guests. I'd like to ask each of them for about a 10-minute discussion, conversation about what's going on with their particular countries in this issue. Starting, yeah.
Do you want us to come up there, or
you can do whatever's more comfortable.
Well, I think it's so much.
I'll just be seated here. So, thank you very much for the introduction, and thanks for letting me speak first, because this way you don't always have to apologize. Well, this already has been said, and whatever. So
thank you.
He's already apologizing for you.
Yeah. No, this subject that we're dealing today has quite a number of facets and aspects, and we definitely won't be able to cover them in depth today. Otherwise, we'll be sitting here until tomorrow, whatever. So, but I don't think we have that much time. So in my 10 minutes or whatever I have, I'd like to just give you a short glimpse on what is happening in Germany, what the situation in Germany is like at the moment. We have about 4 million Muslims. Closer to the mic. Okay. or perhaps, or if you just give me that mic, then I can.
I think that would be the easiest.
Yeah, I think that's. Oh yeah, that makes a big difference. Okay, so I think that's much better like this. Okay, so situation Germany. Becca, we have about 4 million Muslims living in Germany out of a population of a little bit over 80 million. That would make about 5% of the population. And Pew Research Center said that by 2030 we would have probably 7%. So it will grow quite a bit, about 50%. Out of those 4 million, about 2.7 million come from Turkey. So either their parents or grandparents migrated from Turkey to Germany. This started actually already in the 60s and 70s of last year as we were looking for guest workers to come, and many came from Spain, from Portugal, from Italy, from Greece, the southern Mediterranean countries, but also a lot came from Turkey. And they assimilated not that easily as all the other guest workers that came at that time from the Mediterranean countries. Now, 50% of those 2.7 million now have the German citizenship. They have normally a double nationality, double citizenship. And there you find different numbers, as just 2 weeks ago, a distinguished gentleman from Poland here, he gave the numbers of Muslims in Europe, and he said about 1.9% of Muslims in Germany, but those were only foreigners. We've got lots of Germans who are Muslims now because of this huge migration, especially from Turkey. The large percentage of Turks means that we have less problems than some. I think Pauline will give you a different picture of the background of Muslims in France. Turks normally are not, especially what the Middle Eastern peace process or the situation in the Middle East is concerned, they are less politicized, less radicalized, but of course they are Muslims, and they bring their religious traditions with them. So the danger of radicalization, unfortunately, also with those Turks is growing. There are language problems. There is about 30% of young Turks, even coming from families who have been living in Germany for 20, 30 years, and they are third generation, actually, very often. Their language ability is limited, and we have about 30% of people who don't get a high school grade. They leave high school without a grade, and that means that there is a very high percentage of unemployment, and those, of course, are youngsters then that to bolster their self-esteem, it just takes one radicalized imam in a mosque, and they're easy prey for those people. We have about 500 to 600 young Germans with a migration background, or sometimes also without the migration background, who are fighting in Syria. We have about 230 who by now have returned from Syria and pose a problem, of course. I mean, we heard about the terror act, the attack on the museum in Brussels. This was a guy who came back from Syria, and our authorities are also well aware of this special problem these returnees mean for us. And some of the radicals are actually, there are German converts. So they converted, and they mostly are also unemployed or have a very checkered background. And again, they find something with Islam, you know, that give them some structure, some hold, and they have been easily radicalized. Now, there has been, because of that, also there is a growing resentment in the German population. And the study of the Bertelsmann Foundation found that in 2015, about 53% of Germans thought that Islam was very or quite menacing, and 61% said that Islam does not conform with the Western world, doesn't belong in the Western world, and doesn't conform with Western values. Now, officially, we have a different angle there. And Chancellor Merkel echoed a remark that former President Christian Wolff made a couple of years ago, who said that Islam belongs to Germany. And this actually triggered a huge discussion. And there were quite a number of people who have difficulties to go along with that view, because they say the freedom of religion, of course, this is something that Muslims living in Germany, they belong to Germany, but Islam and what it stands for doesn't necessarily belong to Germany, doesn't belong to the Western values. And it is, of course, difficult always to define what is Islam, because if there are so many different imams, there are so many different schools, ISIS has a totally different take on Islam than other scholars in other countries. But I just give you two little examples. It's after 9/11, there was a representative of the Islamic, the Muslim society in Germany, a Saudi Arabian medical doctor, very westernized. He had a beard, closely cropped beard. He had a suit, and he was not. He didn't have this typical ISIS or ISIL appearance. And he was giving an interview to one of our news magazines, Focus. And he started out the interview saying that I welcome the opportunity to talk to you about the subject, and also to take this opportunity to interview to allay the fears that many Germans have about Islam, about the Islamic minority here in Germany. And I just want to tell them the difference. The Sharia even allows us to not adhere to Sharia in countries where we don't have the majority, which I find a little puzzling. I mean, this is something that I didn't like that too much, because that means that once we have 51%, you know, we'd like to hack off hands and heads on the marketplaces in Berlin or Rotenburg up the Tauber. So this is not exactly, you know, what the kind of future you envision for your country. And another example is one of my own colleagues, an ambassador on the German Foreign Service. He converted to Islam, and one colleague of mine told me about a long conversation and discussion she had with him, and she said, I couldn't believe it, you know, this is, he tried to convince me that, of course, in court, Germans have less rights and less value than women when they give testimony. And he tried to convince her, and she said, God, you know, this is my German ambassador, and he's not even clinging to the most basic rights that we have in our constitution. So this is one of the things, you know, that I want to say, that you don't only have to look at the people who cut off heads or who are the ISIL or ISIS, you know, you really have to look at Islam as such, and the support for Sharia and the role of women is something that that really makes it different from our concept. I just have some numbers here. It's the support for Sharia in Iraq, of course, 91%, and even Indonesia, 72%. It goes down to Turkey, 12%, but Malaysia, 80%, Pakistan, and a wife must obey her husband. In Southeast Asia, 93% of the Muslims say, yes, that's the way it should be. South Asia, 88%, Middle East, North Africa, 87%, even Southern and Eastern Europe, 43%. So it's a different. They have a different set of values, and one has to deal with that. And what can be done now? I think there is no clash of civilization. One shouldn't be carried away and dramatize that unnecessarily. But what has to be done is to draw a very, very clear line, and wrongly applied political correctness emboldens the radical elements and withholds badly needed support for those many, many Muslims who live in the Western world who have gone through the period of enlightenment, and they have a very, very modern Islam, but I think our societies have to make it very clear where we stand on that and support actually those many, many moderate Muslims who, I think, still form the majority of Muslims. I think there are many, many more things, but I will leave that for the question and answer then afterwards, and we have some more time for that. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks for welcoming me here. So I wanted to start from the recent terrorist attacks in Paris, because first it was a shock for the whole society, for the whole country, and because it triggered a set of measures. A lot of measures were adopted. Other measures are still under adoption, under thinking, and it really aroused the feeling that now we have to take it really really seriously, which was not obviously the case before. So first, I wanted to recall that we got a lot of support following the attacks, a lot of support from here, from you, in the U.S., all over the U.S., and in California. There were a lot of messages, marches, messages from the American authorities at federal, at state level, at the city level. So it was really, you know, overwhelming to have these, this kind of support. France has taken several measures to respond to the attacks and to avoid the repetition of such an event. And up to now, the action has been threefold: protect, prevent, and educate. And of course, it's a huge program, and many, many questions are still open, of course. First, protect. Of course, the protection of the Jewish community was the first priority. And you may know that we have in France the first Jewish community in Europe and the third in the world after the US and Israel. And so clearly, since the attacks were directed against the Jewish community, against our values, it was immediately decided to deploy soldiers, in addition to police officers already in place, to protect our Jewish compatriots, so to protect the Jewish schools and the synagogues. As you may also know, France has passed in 1990 one of the world's harshest laws criminalizing the denial of the Holocaust. So this is, you know, one of the answers to refusing rise of Islamic terrorism. There are some limits. We have a different approach towards freedom of expression, and this is clearly one of the limits defined by the law. So denying the Holocaust is clearly forbidden. And it's not part of the freedom of expression, definitely, in France. But we also protected the mosques, of course, because, you know, there were, following the attacks, there were some anti-Muslim attacks, and I'll come back to it, you know, in what should be done. Of course, special surveillance has been dedicated to all the public spaces, train station, tourist areas. Then prevent. The attacks showed us that we still had some gray areas, and that the means offered to the police, to the judges, to intelligence services were not enough to tackle terrorism. So new measures, a new legal basis has been adopted to tackle terrorism linked with radical Islam. So first, now the law made it possible to confiscate passports to people coming back from the Middle East, from combat areas, so coming back from Syria, from Iraq, from Libya. The law is the same law which was adopted in November last year, actually just before the attack, but so showing that the awareness had begun to arise. The law also permits now to block racist websites. It has created a new criminal charge of individual terrorist enterprise. And it also aims at creating, but this is part of the European Union, so it's more complicated, the European equivalent to the PNR, passenger names record, but we have to discuss it within the European Union. A hotline has also been opened for families fearing that their relatives are on the verge of radicalization. So this is new, and this hotline has received a lot of messages from mothers, you know, saying, "Wow, my son is, you know, turning towards radicalization." We are mobilizing more funds and personnel to reinforce our intelligence services, and currently a draft law is under discussion at the Parliament to give more power to the intelligence services. So it's, you know, this discussion is still, you know, it's quite controversial because the issue, as you know, here in the US, and you've been knowing it for you know, since September 11, it's always how to combine these measures and combating terrorism, and of course the respect of individual liberties and all our shared values. And this draft law is very controversial in France, and many people, you know, journalists, lawyers, academics are criticizing the fact that the government wants to, you know, to give more police rights to the intelligence services. We also pay special attention to the internet and social networks, because they are, as you know, as we all know here, they are wonderful means to foster education and spread knowledge. But at the same time, they are also means to recruit jihadists and to perpetrate terrorist acts. So the French Minister of the Interior came to San Francisco a few months ago in February, and he initiated a very constructive discussion with the major internet actors, Google, Apple, Facebook, and Twitter. A follow-up meeting took place in Paris 2 weeks ago, and the idea is really to work constructively and to build dialogue, a direct dialogues, in order for these actors, these internet providers, who are, you know, they are settled here, very far away from France, and not necessarily having, you know, a clear understanding on what's at stake, of course, because Silicon Valley is not directly, hopefully it's not directly threatened by Islamic terrorism, it's my Islamic radicalization. The third part of the effort, and it's a very difficult one, is educate and integrate. Education has been a priority for decades. For instance, since the 1980s, teaching of the Holocaust has been mandatory in French primary schools, junior and high schools. But it has to be reinforced. It's never enough. And we also need to reinforce the teaching of tolerance and of civic education, which, you know, and some measures which will be implemented from next September in France, so the next school year, are quite close to what's going on in the US, you know, in terms of paying tribute to the flag or to the anthem or these kind of things which, you know, were considered as quite old-fashioned. It's not old-fashioned at all. And now politicians come to the view that, well, we have lost. We seem to have lost something in terms of civic education. And of course, the main challenge is how to better work, how to better integrate our Muslim compatriots. We have no ethnic, no religious data in France, so it's a bit difficult to know, to have exact figures. The estimates is that they represent about 8% of the population. And of course, the huge majority of them are, you know, moderate Muslims, and they're not terrorists at all. And some of the victims of the terrorists were actually Muslims. You know, in 2012, when in Toulouse, a terrorist attacked the Hazar HaTorah Jewish school, a soldier, a Muslim soldier, was shot. In front of Charlie Hebdo offices, a Muslim police officer, Ahmed Merabet, was shot by the terrorists. The difficulty is that these, you know, as Stefan was saying, they come for a majority from a Middle East country and from Northern African countries. And a lot of them came, they settled in France in the 1960s to help rebuild the countries. And they were coming from, you know, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, former French colonies or protectorates. And so this, you know, now the country is suffering a very deep economic crisis. And these people who were the, you know, the latest to arrive, they are very strongly hit by the economic crisis. And this resentment meddles with, you know, political issues, so issues linked to decolonization, issues linked with, you know, the Middle East and Israel and Palestine issue. Another, you know, what makes things maybe even more difficult in France is that in terms of how to integrate this, you know, people from this religion, is that, you know, France is a secular state. It's the, you know, laïque, un état laïque, laïcité was installed at the very beginning of the 20th century. And laïcité, you know, it's a very combative, word. It was installed at that time in 1905 to keep Catholic religion out from the government. So it's a completely different process from, you know, secularity in the United States, which aims at keeping, having all the religions, all the people being able to live happily together. In France, laïcité was installed, you know, against and to protect the state, the government, from the interventions of the Catholic religion. And in this context, it's quite, you know, it's really difficult to find good interlocutors and moderate interlocutors within the Muslim community, and to find people, you know, able to discuss about how to how the Muslim faith, how Islam in France can work towards more secularization, you know, a process which was made by the Jewish community in the 19th century, and it was not easy, but the process, you know, very at the end, you know, Jewish people, since they got the French citizenship at the end of the 18th century, then they were, you know, quite easily integrated, and I think we have to find kind ways to launch this process with the Muslim community, knowing that, you know, we have a very huge difficulty in finding interlocutors. Last few words about international cooperation, because of course it's the we're not the only one to be attacked, and international cooperation is key in the fight against terrorism. So France is and has been a very strong ally from the United States in, you know, intervening and fighting radical Islam abroad. France intervened in Mali in January 2013 to stop terrorist militants who were about to take control of Bamako, the capital. We were the first country to join the U.S. in the protection of Christian and Kurdish people in northern Iraq. And the last, you know, it leads me to the issue of foreign fighters, which is a global challenge, especially among European nations, and Stefan was speaking about it. The estimate is that more than 1,000 French citizens are involved in terrorist activities linked to Libya, to Syria, to Iraq. Around, you know, between 300 to 500 are currently fighting on the ground. 200 have lost their life in on the ground, and this is it's definitely a very huge challenge that we have to tackle. We have to tackle together. There's a very efficient propaganda from ISIS, and so we have to combat it, to tackle it. But we also have to invent a positive propaganda. And this is linked to the the role that internet can play. We have to work on this, to work on positive messages in order to avoid the moment when the Muslim moderate turns to a radical Muslim or just a basic French citizen which has absolutely no Muslim backgrounds decides to convert and to combat on the ground. So I think positive inventing a positive propaganda is something that will be key in the next few years. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me today and to be joining my two esteemed colleagues. I wanted to take my time, the time that I have, and focus a little bit more or focus less on the present and the future and try to focus more on the past, because I think that's a big lesson for the future. And the past, I think, starts quite long time ago, but I only have 10 minutes. So I won't go back to the Crusaders' time and the battle between Christians and Muslims over areas in the Middle East and in Israel, but I do think I need to go back, and I decided that I'm going to go as far as Lawrence of Arabia or the First World War, because that was the time when the world of Arabism, the Arab Awakening, as you see on the slide here, and I brought a few slides with me, was first introduced. What was special about that is that the Arab world, which is for many years has been a synonym to the Middle East, the Middle East is the Arab world, the Arab world is the Middle East, about 300 million, we're talking about 300 million populations, most of the countries are Arab, most of the territory is Arab, was looking very different before the First World War. And the Arab Awakening, or the Arab Spring, has received a lot of good PR about 4 or 5 years ago. This is just something that we found on a T-shirt. That's a drawing on a T-shirt that was trying to kind of make fun and make a nice joke about what's happening there. So I thought I'll just bring it, because the world were looking at what was happening in the Middle East as, oh, this is very similar to what happened during that time, a more democratic movement, a spring. But that is not the reality today. So for those of you who like to continue to look at this, I apologize. I'll have to move to the next one. So as I said before, the borders were very different before the First World War. And the Ottoman Empire was the one who ruled the place, and you can see on the two top how it looked 400 or 500 years ago and how it looked about 150 years ago. But what's important to say is that the borders that we know today, if you look at them, borders of Iraq, borders of Syria, borders of Jordan, Egypt, etc., most of them are straight borders, meaning they were made by men. Okay? So people looked at the map, they took a ruler, they took a pencil, and they decided, how are we going to divide it? Those divisions were according to the interest of Britain and France, mostly, and not necessarily to the interest of the locals. But what I want to also emphasize is that it was a secular model. It was a secular model introduced to the Middle East by France and Britain. Actually, it was admired by the local population, by the Arab population. They adopted it. Parliaments, wearing ties and suits. It was very secular. In fact, if you think about the 50s or the 60s or the 40s, and you know what, even through the 70s and maybe the 80s, the word Islam was not that present in the Middle East. You could study in a prestigious university about the Middle East in the 70s and maybe not take even one course on Islam and you will graduate. You could have a 4 hours dinner conversation or a presentation at the Commonwealth Club about the Middle East and the word Islam would not come up. Because it was all about Arabism. It was a national movement. It was a national model of similar to what happened in Europe, the rise of nationalism. That was the dominant thing in the Middle East. Now, what happened in the last, I would say, 20, 25 years is a weakening, a predicament of those Arab countries. For example, and I'm keeping this map on purpose because I wanted to look at the one that has 1880 under it. If you look at the one which is on your right, upper corner, I think, yes. You look at Egypt, at the borders of Egypt at that time, it extends well down into the what's today Sudan. Sudan was always under the influence of Egypt, not just by territory back then, but by political influence. Sudan could not move things by themselves without the Egyptian consent. The president of Egypt could tell Sudan what to do. It was under their scope of influence. But if you remember Darfur, okay, the genocide in Darfur, which was not reported that much for the same reasons that Phil said before, because who's going to send a reporter to such a dangerous area? So we heard about it, but we didn't really heard about the travesties that were happening there. What's interesting is that Darfur could happen because while Egypt did not agree to it. Egypt opposed it. Egypt had no responsibility whatsoever, but that's exactly my point. Egypt did not have influence anymore about what's happening in Sudan. In 2002, an Egyptian minister of foreign affairs comes to visit Jerusalem. He comes to meet with us. He goes to meet with the Palestinian leaders. And he decides to go on the Temple Mountain at the Al-Aqsa Mosque to pray. So he enters the mosque and something amazing happens. I remember I was in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs talking to some of my colleagues who are specialists in Middle Eastern affairs. I'm not a specialist. I don't consider myself one. And they said, this is something remarkable that is happening. It will have implications. What happened at the mosque in 2002? Way before the ISIS and everything else that we all hear about. Palestinians threw shoes at the Egyptian foreign minister. Why is that significant? Because Egypt was the leader of Arab nationalism, was the most respected and honored country in the region. They called the shots. Who would dare throw shoes at an Egyptian minister in an Arab world? In 2002, they dared. That was a symbol that the status of the states, the Arab states, was diminishing. Now, when you throw shoes at somebody in the Arab world, if you remember, President Bush almost received one in Iraq, it's not because they didn't have a heavy book or a microphone to throw at him. It's an act of humiliation. You take the dirty thing that you take off when you go into a mosque, you wash your feet, right? So throwing a shoe at somebody, it's an act of humiliation. It was disrespect towards the structure of the state. And if I can go on and describe another tendency in the Middle East later, most of the Arab countries align themselves with the Soviet Union. What's special about the Soviet Union? One thing for sure, it was very, very secular. There was no room for religion. And in fact, Arab countries aligned themselves because religion didn't have a role in Arab countries. The first time ever that clergy ruled a Muslim country was the Islamic Revolution in Iran. So the rule of clergy in Iran, and that's not an Arab country, by the way, right? It's Persia. So when you have clergy ruling an Islamic country, that was never ever happened in history of the Middle East. So another secular model that influenced the Middle East and the politics and the psychic and the society of the Middle East. So if I put a map here, because many times when I speak in the United States about Israel and the region, so it's hard to imagine. So I wanted to do that. So let's go from country to country. So Egypt, yes, lost a lot of its influence over the environment, over their area. Iraq was a big country, used to set or determine political agendas in the region, but after Saddam Hussein was gone, I'm not saying there were positive agendas, but I'm just saying agendas. So after Saddam Hussein was gone, they're no longer setting agendas. They can hardly survive. There maybe in the future they would never be in Iraq, maybe a three type of Sunni, Shiite, Kurdish parts. Saudi Arabia, always one foot here, one foot there, never really saying something that everybody understands. Do you agree or disagree with anything? Jordan, good neighbor to us, but always experiencing an existential threat, and economy maybe 10% of that of Israel, never really setting agendas in the region. And if you continue to look around, Syria for many years under the father of the current president was setting agendas in the region. But for 10, 15 years, who's setting the agendas for Syria? It's Iran, it's others. It's not really them who are setting their own agendas. So you look at a large Arab Middle East, and if you go west, you know, Tunisia, Algeria, not really big setters of agendas of the Middle East and North Africa. Libya, they were doing that. Gaddafi was doing it for quite a few years, but then at a certain moment he decided he's going to give up on that. And from a big tiger that was setting negative agendas, he stopped setting any agenda and just drifted to wherever he is today. So you have an Arab world, a whole Arab world with 300 million people who feel that they cannot set their own political agendas. This is a little bit humiliating if you understand Arab mentality. And here we live in a country where on your Declaration of Independence it says that everybody has a right for life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, right? Pursuit of so life you have, and liberty you do have here, and the pursuit of happiness is what you're pursuing really on your daily basis. So this is why people get divorced, because they want to be happy, right? In the Middle East, it's something else. It's not the pursuit of happiness. It's the pursuit of honor. This is why you have honor killing. This is why you have people don't get divorced there. And again, I don't have much time. But this is what drives the processes over there, honor, dignity. So my colleague here spoke about Tunisia and about are there more radical or less radical Muslims in France. So just that you know that when the Tunisian revolution happened and they went to election, so the Muslim Brotherhood or Muslim Party came to power, it's interesting to know that the Tunisians who live in France voted in higher percentage for the Muslim party than Tunisians who live in Tunisia. They have this system of absentee votes like you do. What was it? Was it freedoms? No, they had the freedoms. Was it the economy? Was it what is it? It was the honor. We wanted to set our own agendas. And that's what changed. So if you look at other things, economic or other things, so this is GNP per capita. So if you see the lower it is, less stable it is. That's not a surprise, okay? But it's important to say it. Those countries under the current regime or the previous regime that they had, I'm talking about Egypt, Tunisia, Syria, Yemen, all those countries, people felt disenfranchised. They didn't have control over their lives. They didn't have control over their future. They didn't have control over their economy. They didn't have control over their freedoms, women's status, children's status, anything. So, dignity, honor. You don't have that. Life expectancy rank, okay? So, here, the lower it is, the better it is. This is like how many deaths per 1,000, I think, or 10,000. I don't remember exactly, but I mean, if you have a longer line, your situation is worse, okay? So unstableness, yes, in those countries who are on your right. Status of women. This is a report by the United Nations from 2005 saying that if you're not going to solve the status of women issue in Arab countries, you're not going to be developing yourself. Half of your population is not participating in the workforce, is not participating in social life. So what do people do when they're getting disappointed with the regime, with the with the current regime, a secular model based on European models, I'll move on. You go to more basic instincts. What are the basic instincts that live, that are in the Middle East? It's religion, it's tribal, and it's sectarian. So there, everybody heard that there are problems in Yemen, fighting in Yemen. It used to be south and east, north Yemen. You look at the map, the dark green is the Shiites. So where you have a friction line between Shiites and Sunnis, today you have frictions. Who spoke about Sunnis and Shiites 20, 30, 40 years ago? Nobody. Now it's coming back. All divisions are returning back to the Middle East. Certainly in Iraq, in Syria, you can see those green dots. Sectarian, this is Syria. Okay, so this is a map of different sects that live in Syria. Okay, nobody took attention to that when the British and the French drew those lines. But what happens today, it's a big mess, it's a bloody mess. But if you think about the first city where the fierce fighting started, you don't have to know its name. You have just to look where the different colors are together, and it will not surprise you that it was the city of Homs, which is... how do I point it? Yeah, anyway, I'll do that. So this is a map that was found in Afghanistan over 10 years ago. When you want your honor, when you want your dignity, when you're going back to your basic instincts, national borders do not matter. You have one purpose. You want to maybe take control over your fate, over your future, and over your honor. This is a map of the United States of Islam. Thank you very much.
Thank our panelists for their comments. And I'd also like to remind that we have listening audiences on the internet, on radio. This is a Commonwealth Club of California. It's a program called The Rise of Islamic Radicalism. Our panelists are Paulina Carmona, Consul General of France, Stefan Schluter, Consul General of Germany, and Andy David, who we just heard from, Consul General of Israel. We have a lot of questions and not so much time. I just have to say that it's coming from a place of hysteria, which is where I started at the podium, because of cable television and our own media. I don't feel any less hysterical. I feel much better educated. I feel that... there were a lot of facts and defenses provided here today, and I mean defenses in a good sense, but that we are kind of shoring things up with those facts and those defenses. And at the same time, what's happening in large swaths of the Middle East is that a caliphate is, in fact, being created on the ground. This is why President Obama likes to call it ISIL, because calling it ISIS acknowledges a little bit more that they hold territory and then it's a nation in their view. I'm glad that Pauline addressed the social media aspects of that, because Facebook and Twitter and the other social media, they are the command and control of ISIS. And I think what talking about education, we should talk about that much more. We should talk about assimilation. Because when you see the rare moments of video, which are slickly produced by ISIS, the most extraordinary public relations campaign I've ever seen, and when you think about the horrific violence that's included in that public relations campaign, and that people still are drawn to it, that young people from France who are French citizens or immigrants, young people from Germany, I suspect in Israel this is not the case, are drawn...
Very few from the Arab Israeli community.
Okay, are drawn, and Andy went through a fascinating history, going back to a certain point, but as the author of the Atlantic Monthly article reminded us, we have to go back 1,300 years to understand the brand of Islam that ISIS apparently believes in. So let me get to some audience questions. There was a question about, with all due respect, why are there no Muslims on the panel? And Celia said, last month we had a panel of Muslims discussing the Islamic State. So if you keep coming to these things, you will get a very rounded view. This question, I keep remembering Bader Meinhof, Red Brigades, even Black September. They burned out like a fever. How is ISIS different? So how is ISIS different, Stefan?
Well, I think that, I think this is the best one here, so it's a, Bader Meinhof, also Black September, I think that those were very isolated groups who flared up for a while, who didn't have the wide support in the population and who didn't have a wide-ranging agenda. And wherever religion comes in, I think its movements are much more forceful. Could be for the better, but for the worse. And with ISIL, of course, it's for the worse, but they have much more clout if you come with the Quran, with come with religious beliefs.
Do we understand the sense of community that apparently is created in area controlled by ISIS? In other words, there's a U.S. journalist, Sebastian Younger, who's a war correspondent, famous war correspondent, very sort of testosterone-y kind of reporting, but has written very recently about post-traumatic stress, his own and others, and the rest of us who cover these conflicts in addition to our combatants, and that the post-traumatic stress issue is less about what happens in battle, where you are in a tight community of your peers, and what happens when you come home and you don't find the adrenaline, you don't find the community, you don't find the closeness. There are thousands and thousands and perhaps tens of thousands of people going to join ISIS from your two countries and others who clearly feel some sense of community there, bolstered by social media. How do you combat that? What do you do about that?
So, yeah, you're right. It's, you know, mainly an issue of, you know, these people lacking values, lacking, you know, family help and community help and education. What happens very frequently is that you know, they you know, even very basic standard, I would say, French citizens, they're from, you know, not really disadvantaged background, but usually the starter of everything is, you know, a petty misdemeanor, and then they arrive in jail. And it's during their first day in jail that they enter in contact with, you know, an imam or so-called imam, because we have no official status of the imams in France. And they enter in contact with people who are, you know, spreading the jihad and trying to convert them. And very frequently, the police and the intelligence service arrived to the conclusion that this first stay in jail is the, you know, the starter of everything. So it's not the only way. And of course, there's the problem of a background of coming from, you know, disadvantaged places or places where unemployment is quite high and they have nothing to do and the sense of the community is not, you know, not strong enough. But this stay in jail is very decisive. So this led the government to, you know, to work on specific measures to isolate, you know, terrorists or people committed to, you know, terrorist activities, to put them in isolated places, isolated sectors in jail, which was not the case before, and also to work much more seriously on the imams working or being at the disposal of the people, of the prisoners, and trying to you know, to better. Better check who these people are and what are they, you know, education, credentials, and so on.
What about, and there are socioeconomic issues clearly that affect this, and yet the EU is not exactly in the greatest of shape at the moment, all due respect to people here. Stefan, you know, since Germany is sort of the central to the economic health of the EU, what kinds of money can you contribute And is that the right way to go in terms of both education and socioeconomic mobility?
No, this is one of the things that we have been doing for years now. It's I don't know if it was met with lots of success, but education, of course, is one of the pivotal ways to deal with unemployment, with frustrated young people, and we're trying to, and we are very successful at that. At least I've got the German numbers to lower the unemployment rate of young people. I mentioned before that, unfortunately, with young Germans or also migrants with a migratory background, that the unemployment rate is fairly high. We have to do something there, but I think we are actually on a good way.
More Muslims are being killed by other Muslims. What we are hearing more is the fringes of an event that happened in Brussels or in France, others, but Muslims are mostly killing other Muslims. It's not about the competition between economies or the competition between faiths. It's about honor. It's not about if Europe is doing well or not doing well in the economy. You know, there are poor people in India, there are poor people in other places. They don't radicalize because it's not enough to be poor. In fact, most of the leaders of biggest terrorist organizations were very rich people, educated, engineers, doctors. So it's about honor. If we don't understand the reasons, how can we deal and find solutions? And in order to do that, we really have to go to the bottom of, or to the roots of the cause of that. And part of that is how they feel towards their own leaders. Is there transparency, accountability, corruption? Do we as Western societies tolerate corruption in those countries? And by tolerating them and supporting them, is our tax dollars, your tax dollars, through aid organizations are giving to governments, and you're seen as part of the problem because you're giving it to a corrupt government. So then you become, I mean, the United States has given Egypt more money than many of the other Arab countries, and still most Egyptians don't like Americans. And there are other countries where you didn't give a cent and they admire you. So you have to understand
the lesson of that is
the lesson of that is that you have to demand something in addition to give the money. Accountability, transparency. Democracy was a theme that ran in I think in many years, like 10 years now, and the U.S. was pushing for democracy, but it was not real democracy. Why? Because it focused on election. Let's have free election. Let's have free election in Gaza, and what you get Hamas. Let's get free election in Lebanon, and you get Hezbollah. Let's get free election in Egypt, and you get the Muslim Brotherhood. Because election is not the beginning of a process. Election is the end of the process. The beginning of a process is freedoms, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, middle class, accountability, transparency, and then when you are a civil society, and then when you have all that, at the end of the process, you may have free elections. If you start with elections, you're going to get those who are the less democratic winning.
Well, again, elections are a long distance from ISIS. And hang on one sec. So the history that you provided is really enlightening. But again, if you go back really 1,300 years to Salafism, which is, I think, what the ISIS practitioners are preaching and practicing in ISIS-held countries, it is appropriate to kill other Muslims. And in fact, you're supposed to if they don't agree with you, because the apostasy is worse if you're a Shiite Muslim who believes in some reform of Islam. If you're a Sunni Salafist, they kill you for that.
They kill all the Sunnis. They burn the Jordanian pilot. He's a Sunni.
Okay, but this is again. You know, we have this really interesting convergence of very old and very, very new. New being the social media aspects, the public relations, the slick PR firms, and the old being the Salafism that...
But why would people join them? Because they feel that they don't have the honor that they deserve, and they will find it over there.
Okay, so maybe honor is another way to put... Community is another way to say there's an honor in, yeah. in community, yeah. and that's...
I'm walking around pride, proud.
Okay, we're quickly running out of time on a fascinating topic. Could one of you comment on the potential for community-level activism and Islamic groups as mediators, as occurred before the 1998 Good Friday Agreement and ultimately successful peace efforts in Northern Ireland? Is that going on in France? Is that going on in Germany?
It's, you know, as I was explaining, it's something which is difficult for us to put in place and to implement because of, you know, our France being a secular and a combative secular country. And we don't have this culture of committing religious leaders, you know, within this kind of dialogue, this kind of efforts, first because we don't have the interlocutors. So we first have to find the interlocutors, good interlocutors. And also it's not really, you know, what happens. I'm quite impressed by, you know, what happens in the US with these interfaith councils, people from representative clericals from different religions going to the schools and explaining to the children, you know, what's the main message of their religion and explaining this in a very tolerant way. It's something that it's, for the time being, you know, completely impossible in a French school, meaning in a French government school, in a French public school, which is the majority of the school. They are owned by the government. So we ask, you know, we ask the French teachers to educate about religion, about religious factors and the main monotheist religions in the world. But we ask the same people who have been, you know, formed and educated in a very secular and laic culture. And it's very, you know, there's a kind of paradox in asking the French teachers who are civil servants who've been educated this way, and now to ask them to explain about the tolerant message of the religions, and they don't know, they're not able to speak about it. And for the time being, you know, once again, I'm very interested by what's by the U.S. system. Where you know, religion is not by definition an enemy, and a religion can enter, clericals can enter the school and explain about this kind of message. You know, you have to take account of the fact that the majority, when you ask people in France whether they believe in God, what's their religion, the very huge majority answer that they are secular. They have no religion, no God.
Okay, just a minute. In Germany, it's a little bit different because we are also a secular country, but still we have our religious communities, and the government is also in constant conversation and contact with the different religious communities. But with a Muslim minority, it's very difficult because they are very fragmented. So we don't really have somebody to talk to. There are many, many different groups and groupings, and you never know for how many people they actually speak. But there are very moderate voices within this community, and we're definitely talking with them.
Andy, I'll use this. Since you're probably in a position to understand and appreciate the history throughout the region better than most, the question here from the audience is, when will Americans be told the truth that Saudi Arabian money is funded extremist fundamentalist terrorists in the Middle East and throughout the world? The answer is probably more complicated than we have time for, but it is, while ISIS is clearly very focused on their mission, we, on the other hand, are not sure, we being Americans, understanding where we're on the side of the Saudis, where we're suddenly on the side of the Iranians, where we're on the side of Shiites, where we're on the side of Sunnis. It differs. And it's everywhere. So can you uncomplicate this for us?
What's the
but
time?
Really uncomplicated. Uncomplicated. In a minute, yes.
As an Israeli, it's difficult for me to give advice to Americans, first of all, because you don't listen.
But that doesn't stop you.
We keep trying, even if it's against protocol. But recently we've had something amazing happening in the Middle East. We had the Israelis and a lot of the other Arab Sunni countries agreeing. And it's the West who doesn't agree with us. So I don't know if I can give advice regarding specifically Saudi Arabia, but I would say this. If you're not going to visit the Middle East, engage, help, take care of people, take care of civil society, educate, invest, and visit, the Middle East is going to visit you. It has in 2001, and it can visit you again. So Saudi Arabia, yes, we have to continue to visit, not just with the leadership is under threat there, by internal forces. We don't know if it's stable enough to sustain. Who can guarantee the same, Saudi Arabia will look the same in 10 years? Nobody in this room. So what do we need to do? We need to guarantee their future through education, assistance, demanding transparency, demanding change of practices slowly, not by yourself, just by yourself, but through the IMF, through the United Nations, through the World Bank, through the many others, and give help while going through those transitions, but also never forget the strongest motivator in the Middle East, in the Arab countries, which is honor. A good example for that is Morocco. Morocco is pretty stable, and they went through a campaign started in 2006 and 2007, I think, where the message was to the radicals is, what are you doing to our motherland? What are you doing to our national honor? And it helped. It worked. A lot of people thought about it twice, and they were. It was basically said that if you're doing something against our values or the practices, you're dishonoring yourself in the eyes of others, and it worked. So if you identify the problem, you may find a solution.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time and then some, but as I walk from here to the podium to bang that gavel, let me ask you for a one-word answer. I quoted former Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge as saying recently that we are more in danger of extremism and terrorism in the United States now than ever than we were on 9/11. We were on 9/12. So let me ask you, yes or no, in your country, are you in the worst? Is the threat level at the highest that it's ever been in general? Yes or no?
In France, yes.
In Germany?
It's about the same. It doesn't go down for the moment, at least.
Okay. Hang on 1 second.
Israel, what?
No.
Oh, I need this microphone. No. Different circumstances. Okay, well, I'd like to thank our panelists, Paulina Carmona, Stefan Schluter, and Andy David, for being very patient and instructive of us. I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club, our audiences here, those listening to the recording, and on the internet. I'm Phil Bronstein, your moderator for today's program, The Rise of Islamic Radicalism. I hope you all feel you've been if not encouraged, educated, and now this meeting, the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.